So today is December 19th, the 23rd of Kislev, 5772, and we're going to do mitzvot. What do we have here? 224 to 229.
I don't even want to pass that.
Okay. So the prohibition on the theft of anything of value. So I do want to say something about Hanukkah too, but first we're going to do this. I hope we'll get to both a little bit. I was trying to think how I can connect it.
Right. Well, that'll be challenging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think I have a way, so we'll see. Okay, so the prohibition on the theft of anything of value, that's 224. So this is geneva, as opposed to 229, which is gezela. So those are the two words that we use for a theft. Geneva is theft of stealth, just stealing something from somebody, whereas gezela is theft of force. Where you take it out of their hand or use force to get it from them. And lignov, to steal, can also mean, like we use to steal in English, to tiptoe, to steal into a place, to go quietly, to steal that way. So it means to steal in both ways. So lignov is to steal in both ways, just like we have it in English. So this is, you're, of course, not permitted to steal. Now, it's interesting, and especially with my children and making me think the way that I am learning how to think around, not all of my children, just a few of them who are challenging some of these laws. I don't want to besmirch the whole pack.
Especially the one sitting here.
Especially the one sitting here.
Throw out the baby with the
mouth. Right. So I'm gathering all the babies. But I do have a few who are questioning me about the origin of Torah laws and why we need them. For instance, do not steal. That's not a chiddush. It's not a new thing. Everybody knows you shouldn't steal. Right? So do we need the Torah to come tell us not to steal?
Of course.
Is the question.
To tell us everything.
Well, so it could be that
Noah was killed. Because it's logical. Know it.
Right, the generation of Noah before the Torah came, they stole. They did not respect boundaries, right? And so they were the whole generation, right? Exactly, was destroyed because they did transgress that which is normal and natural, which they should have gotten just from the air. Everybody knows not to steal.
But experience has shown us that even though we should know something and it's logical and reasonable and intuitive, sometimes
doesn't mean we keep it. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the same thing as not eating extra dessert. We all know it's not good for us. And yet, often, we eat it anyway. Let me close the door. Oh, thank you, Alicia. So it doesn't, logical and reasonable doesn't necessarily add up to the way that we behave. I know Rabbi Beryl Wein once said it would have been good if not stealing was a minhag instead of a halacha. Maybe we
in our community we don't, and in your community you do.
So, but we happen to be very careful with minhagim, so it turns out.
More careful.
Yeah. So anyway, so what is this for? So he addresses that here. He says, the root reason for this precept is known, since it is one of the commandments that reason necessitates. And this is about stealing anything of value. So anything not of value is not included in this biblically. However, it is included in this rabbinically. So what would be not of value? But we're still careful as Jews about it. Let's say using somebody's pen. So how much ink are you stealing? Right? It's under a pruta's worth. And a pruta is the smallest coin. So if you use somebody else's pen without asking them to sign your name on a check, it is stealing. Right? But it's not stealing that kicks into this biblical prohibition because it's not anything of value that you've stolen. However, rabbinically, it's still stealing. You're not allowed to do it. You do have to ask.
So you have to ask. Yep. Isn't also one of the discussions about stealing time?
Yes. Stealing time and stealing opinions. Right? And stealing sleep. Right.
Mm-hmm. Stealing sleep.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed to wake somebody up. If they didn't ask, if they're sleeping, you're not supposed to wake them up. That's considered stealing sleep.
Really?
If it's not the right time to wake them up, it's not your job to wake them up.
The middle of the night, like you don't just wake them up and say, I just had this great dream.
Right. Not allowed to do that. Okay. I think possibly if somebody's napping in the middle of the day, too. Now, it depends. I'm sure there's different, I don't know all the rules of stealing sleep, and that's not what this one discusses. But, yeah, you're not allowed to steal sleep either. And we did earlier talk about stealing thoughts, stealing ideas. Well, that's two different things. One is stealing thoughts. So stealing their thoughts about you, gnevas das, stealing, it's interesting it's called das, gnevas dat, because one way to translate dat, which is knowledge, is connection. And that's what you're not allowed to steal, is that sense of connection. Right? So you're not, the classic example that the Rambam uses is, let's say you're selling olives in the market, and you just finished, you sold your last olive from the bottom of the barrel, and now a customer is approaching you, a regular customer, right? And you have to open a new barrel of olives anyway. You're not allowed to tell that customer, for you, I'll open fresh. Because you're about to open it anyway. So you can't use the opportunity that you're anyway opening fresh to make that person feel like you're more connected to him than you are.
Interesting.
Right? So you're not allowed to. So just same thing, you're not allowed to invite somebody if you know they're going to be out of town. I mean, you can invite, let's say that you're making a wedding, but you know they're going to Australia to see their kids. You can invite them if you would have invited them anyway. But let's say you're making a very small wedding and you're just only inviting them so they should feel like they're invited, but you wouldn't invite them if you knew they would be in town. You're not allowed to invite them.
Okay. So the converse of that would be, for example, if you're having an out-of-town wedding and you don't, and you know somebody won't come because it's out of town and all that.
So that's different. I mean, there is, for instance, in Denver, there is a custom to invite, on the west side anyway, everybody invites the entire west side list. Right? They don't pick and choose, usually. They just invite everybody. So for an out-of-town wedding, they would be surprised if the entire west side came and probably would not be expecting it. But they are invited. But the way it works is it's a self-selecting process. The entire west side is invited. Those who feel like spending the $400 on airfare and the car and the house so they go. That's a good enough friend that you want them to attend. So, but it's not that in that case, it's not considered Gnevas Das to invite the whole place.
Because everybody.
Because that is the custom, right? So that's what I was saying. It would be hard to know. Let's say, for instance, an afternoon nap, right? You're in Mexico. Everybody's, got their feet up on the porch with a sombrero over their face. Are you allowed to wake somebody up there or not? It really probably depends on the social mores of the place. Yeah. Like, is that sacred sleep that nobody wakes up anybody between 1 and 3?
So as long as it's after 3, it's okay.
Right,
if it's at
right.
2, it's not okay.
Right, right. So that it just depends.
Or if you're having an emergency and...
Right, all that, yeah, for sure. But that, I mean, I think it all depends on... There's a lot of stuff like that. It depends on the cultural stuff. But meanwhile, this is... You can't steal... This is actually talking about an item. You're not allowed to steal any item that has any value at all. That is a Torah prohibition, and it's obvious. Let's see. Well, he talks about why. Let's see if I can see it. So there's all kinds of different... Oh, and then you're not allowed to buy anything from somebody who's a notorious thief. So you don't have to check every single person in the market how they got their thing. But if you know that person's a thief... Now, it's hard for us to know that, but in the olden days, so you knew who was the thief.
So you shouldn't buy the purse on the street.
Well, so and I would say today, yes.
I say that all the time.
Yes. That definitely seems to be the case.
Because
you know, you don't know that person.
The copyright. Well, the copyright for sure is stolen.
Right. Right.
The design for sure is stolen.
Yeah, I mean, either it's a knockoff or the item is not a knockoff and it was stolen. Or I mean, it's one of
several options. Right, so if you're buying something from the back of a truck, it's a very good guess.
Refrigerator from the back of the truck.
Right, it's a very good guess that was stolen.
Yeah.
You don't know for sure, but we do. So we don't know that person as a thief because we don't know that person. But we know that that type of sale is usually associated with stolen goods. So even if we don't know for sure, so maybe we could if we would check it out at that person at that time. But let's say it's just a regular sale. You're going to Machane Yehuda, and then there's a guy who's selling whatever, all kinds of eclectic stuff, and there's a teapot there that you like. So you could buy that. You don't have to guess that it was stolen, even if it's an antique teapot. That's a one of a kind, but you don't have to wonder.
Well, let me ask, except wouldn't there be, for example, we were in... Poland, or I don't know, one of the Eastern European countries, and we were at a flea market, and there was a lot of Judaica there, and it had clearly been stolen from somebody.
At some point, but decades ago. You don't know if that person stole it, or how they acquired
and
it.
And we bought it because we felt like it was the right thing to
repatriate
it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Right.
So that would be okay?
Yeah, I think so, because that's what it's saying here, is that it's interesting. So let's just look at the last paragraph on page 29. There's what the sages said, that for a notorious thief, they did not establish the amendment of the market. So there's a principle called the amendment of the market, that if someone buys a stolen object from a thief, the owner is to refund him the money and sue the thief. So
that's an innocent purchase.
Right. Once it's in the market, we're not held responsible unless it's a notorious thief. Right.
It's just fascinating to me how many of these things are incorporated into our laws.
Uh-huh. Right.
I mean, even down to specific details, it's just amazing.
As a lawyer, you would know that. Yeah,
it's just fascinating.
It is fascinating, right.
So, right, okay.
So the owner has the right to buy it. So there's the original owner, and then there's the buyer, right? So the buyer has to give it up to the original owner for the purchase price. You bought it for $30.
You have to give it back.
You have to give it back for
$30. But he has to pay you the $30.
He has to pay you the $30 for it because you bought it fair and square. So he's allowed to get his thing back, but he has to give you the $30, and then he sues the thief for the $30
or whatever the penalty is.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's fascinating.
So that works if he's not a notorious thief, but if he is a notorious thief, then he has to give it back, and he can sue the. How does that work? The owner can sue. The buyer can sue the thief if he is a notorious thief, right? So then it's not on the owner.
So in other words, that gets back to sort of knowledge. If you bought it knowing or you should have known that it
right.
was stolen, then you
right.
are not relieved of responsibility.
Right.
Only
right.
if you're innocent.
Right, right, exactly.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, the owner returns the buyer his money and takes the object.
Right.
And then the owner can sue the thief.
Right. And this is, and it applies to Jews and to non-Jews. You're not allowed to steal from a non-Jew either, even an idol worshiper. From an adult or from a child, not permitted to steal at all whatsoever from anybody. And it says specifically, I think it's later on in Gezeilah, it says that even somebody who you're allowed to kill, so let's say an idol worshiper that you're permitted to kill, you still can't steal from them.
So stealing is way high up there on the list.
It's not that
it
so you might think that would be one way to look at it, is that it's worse to steal than it is to kill. I don't think that's it.
But it forbids it. What it does is it then forbids looting.
Correct.
Yeah.
So for two reasons. Right.
Well, or an idol worshiper, you kill him, but you can't loot from his family or something.
Right. So that's what it is. He might have righteous descendants, and it really belongs to them. So you're not allowed to take it from somebody that you're permitted to kill. But not just that. Let's say you're not able to kill the person for whatever reason. You just want to steal from them because, you know, you could kill them and they would be dead. They wouldn't own it anyway, so you might as well take it. Right? You might have that kind of logical thing in your mind. Not allowed to steal because it's bad for you.
That's what I was just going to say. I was going to say it's like doing a lot of those things that really sort of create a stain, as it were, on your own
right, exactly.
soul.
Right, it's a bad behavior to engage in, and we know that the Sefer HaChinuch, the author of the Sefer HaChinuch, is a behaviorist, and so he's very clear. I mean, that the way he explains a lot of mitzvot is the effect that it has on you, and so that's what he explains here also. And as we see, we'll continue on that it's not good for you. So why then does God have a lot of laws against stealing? I'm trying to see which one that was in because you know I want to read a bunch of them. So. Trying to see where it is, that he's not trying to add on extra averas onto us. He's trying to add on extra pathways for righteousness when we refrain from doing it.
Gotcha.
So really that's the goal here is, so it's important just to remember that it's not just, the point of the mitzvah is not just to maintain a civil society, which is one reason. Everybody could see that by logic, so the Torah doesn't have to command it. Right, civil societies have to run in a certain way, and not stealing from each other is absolutely one of the foundations of a civil society.
Mm-hmm. However, rule of law.
Right? However, that's the rule of law, and that's just obvious. That should be anyway. The Torah doesn't need to come to command that. It's not a chiddush, right? However, the Torah does command that, so that it should have the force of Torah law, and that does keep some extra people in check. But really, B, because every mitzvah is a pathway to spiritual growth. Or to make it clear that every negative mitzvah is a pathway to spiritual diminishment. So if you want to know how to not diminish yourself, avoid these things that the Torah says don't do. Right? So it's not just about how to run a society, but it's about how to grow or protect your soul. So
and create connections.
And create connections, right. So create connections and not destroy connections. So that's what the mitzvot are about here. So that's what he's saying very clearly. So the first one is not to... not to steal anything of value. Okay. Where do we get up to? How do I flip the pages? Okay, 225. Not to deny it when some... Oh, there's one other thing I wanted to point out here. Let's see. I think it was in this one. Where it says that you can't buy from... Right, okay. Let's just look at this paragraph on page 29 because it's interesting. Is that where it says you can't buy from women too? Yeah, it does. Okay, so let's just read this whole paragraph in the middle of the page. There is the law of the person who steals a sella from his fellow's purse or house, right?
Yeah, I see it.
And he returns the stolen object to its place with or without the owner's knowledge. What is the law for him? So that's just, it doesn't say what the law is. It's just saying that these are extra things you're going to find when you look it up in the right tractate in the Torah in Baba Kama. It discusses all these things. Let's see. And under what circumstances counting by the owner frees him from the penalty? I don't know what that refers to. Let's see. And there is the difference that applies in this matter, whether the stolen object was something living, such as animals, or something inanimate, as taught in the chapter in chapter 10 of the Talmud Tractate Bava Kama. Further, there is what the sages said, that it is forbidden to buy from a thief, because that would strengthen the hands of wrongdoers. Right, so besides the fact, right, we did talk about that before with the pirates, right? Therefore, sages of blessed memory ruled that wool, milk, and kids, meaning baby goats, should not be bought from shepherds.
Good thing you clarified.
Right. Wool, milk, and kids should not be bought from shepherds. So I think that's interesting because...
Well, I think that's sort of... I think that it's like... it might, and this, and then you go on and it talks about not... buying from the watchman wood or
right
fruit.
Similarly, one should not buy from watchman over wood or fruit except under certain known conditions.
It's because it might sort of entice the shepherd or the watchman
who
or
doesn't own
to
the
do
sheep.
Something
right
that they I mean it's again not putting somebody else sort of in temptation's way
in right you're just
so
making
just
a rule that a shepherd you're generally assuming is not the owner of the flock
right
and the right same so thing if he was the owner of the flock he could but somebody who's hired to watch a flock. You can't buy milk from them or wool from them or a kid from them because that could just be...
You should assume that it doesn't belong to them.
Right, you should just... Right, that would be an assumption that it's not theirs.
But
so, too, nothing but certain known objects are to be bought from women, servants, and children. As a general rule, our sages taught, if any of these said, hide this, it is forbidden to buy it from them. Well, that makes sense.
Well, it's because women didn't have ownership rights.
Right. Well, they had some ownership rights, but not this you would take in the context of the time, for sure. So, and it says, of course, nothing but certain known objects so are to be bought from women, servants, and children. So women, servants, and children in this context would all be in the position of not being in charge of
stuff.
Everything that's going on and all the stuff. So what right do they have to sell? A servant, for sure. A child, for sure. Right? And in this
that
context,
time.
At that time, a woman also. It's not her stuff. How do you... You know, how do you know if she can sell it or not? All right, so except for certain known things, you weren't permitted. So this is just one large category of people whose ownership of whose right to sell that thing might be suspect. Is in question, right. So I thought that was an interesting thing to see. Okay.
There's also the little paragraph here about paying too much. Charging too much.
Right, not allowed to steal.
Did we discuss that?
No.
Not yet.
Okay.
So this discourage women from going into business.
Well, they couldn't.
No, I don't think so. No. I don't think it does. I don't think this mitzvah discourages
women.
No,
but I think
business.
You couldn't be in business at that time unless you were... unmarried woman anyway, could you? I mean, how could you be in business for yourself? Everything
no, you
could
own. No, that's not true. That's
not
true.
The woman that sold the purple cloth? I mean, yeah, well, but
she's got more biblical knowledge than most of us, yeah.
I was going to say, yeah. Wait,
yeah. Obviously, that
not
story
previous.
That we all know about.
I don't.
I was thinking of the woman of Valor.
Uh-huh.
Oh, in Asia's Cup.
Okay. Uh-huh. Well, but so there would be a question. I mean, if her husband supplied the wool to her and she just,
she
wove it or whatever.
Well, it says that she supported her family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It did say
true.
That in Asia's Cup.
So
let's
clarify. Women can own property.
Yeah.
That is not against Jewish law at all. And that is not the thing. She can come into the marriage with her property, and it remains hers and distinct from her husband's. She does not have to give it over to him.
Okay.
But then the question is, inside the marriage, and I don't know the answer, but the question is, inside the marriage, to whom does different things belong?
Is it communal?
What's communal and what could be separate? What can she maintain and what not? I think, but I'm not positive, I'm pretty sure that, let's say, interest or whatever she would gain from what she brought into the marriage would remain hers and separate
think.
And distinct.
Yeah, you would think.
I'm pretty sure. It wouldn't. You would think because that's the right, that's the what we would think today, but I'm pretty sure that's Jewish law from then too. I'm just not an expert on Jewish law, but I know it's not that women were...
Couldn't own any.
No, not at all. Women could own property, so... but often women didn't. I mean, if you think about just the context of the time, also you're getting married at 14, 15, 16.
How did you have anything?
That was that famous story of splitting up the the property,
right? Dividing of the land and the two daughters
who had
passed away,
right? And he had no sons,
right? So what do you own? But let's just say that 14-year-old, 15, 16-year-old gets married, and her husband dies at 20.
So she should, but
then she owns everything. It's hers.
Go to an offspring. Like
let's say they don't have, or let's say they do have, but whatever. Let's she still gets right. So she and she's going into her next marriage with property. That's her property. It belongs to her. It doesn't just get subsumed by the next guy.
So it's not. So it's different. So that would be different. That concept would be different than was present in, let's say, the Christian communities where everything went to the eldest son,
right,
and the woman really wasn't entitled to any ownership of anything,
right? So she for sure gets her ketubah, but I'm pretty sure that so it's interesting because the oldest son gets, let's see, you take the children and you divide them up, the oldest son, but you let's say there's five children, you make six shares because the oldest son gets double. And everybody else gets one share. So there's that. And she gets the ketubah off the top.
So she takes that.
She takes that first. So she for sure gets that. But let's say the children are all little. She is supported to
guardian.
She's supported to raise them. Right. Because they're his kids and they need to be raised. And that works in divorce too. There's no alimony in Jewish divorce. However, if the children are young, the Torah recognizes that the best person to raise them is the mother. So she needs to be supported to raise his children. So it's not that they're his children that he gets to own them, it's that it's his responsibility
to make sure
that they're raised. So he has to hire her to raise his children. That's how she gets protected. That's the alimony. That's how she is protected to have the salary and the whatever the income she needs to be able to raise the children properly. That's her protection. Anyway, so a woman definitely can have business. So this isn't discouraging women from business. Mm-hmm. The society in which women would live would depend on if they had business or not. And the Rambam talks about how women hardly left the house. And if let's say a woman, he has somewhere where he says something like, and I'm just paraphrasing, something like, if a woman wants to go out, you know, at the most once a month to see something, she's permitted, but she shouldn't be frivolously in the streets.
Wandering around.
Right. So...
Only go out with your mother.
Exactly.
It's a different context. So you do have to see some societal norms. That's not the halacha. This is not halacha that women are untrustworthy to purchase from. It's included. It's interesting to see, but it's included in a whole paragraph of people who might not belong to them. Exactly.
Or it also may be to protect women, children, and servants, so that you don't force them into a position of selling something that's not theirs or something.
It doesn't seem like that.
That might be a stretch.
Nothing but certain known objects are to be bought for women, servants, and children. So, and that would be discussed in the Gemara also. Remember, this is not going into all the details of it. So that's in Mishnah Peah. We'll discuss that. That's the note. And certainly if they say something like, hide this. Right?
Right.
So I told you what Rabbi Yaakov Horowitz does a lot of teaching on how to keep kids safe from unwanted physical advances. And so one of the things they teach in his school, where he's the principal, they teach the kids, if a teacher ever, any adult ever says, don't tell your parents, immediately tell your parents. That is the key. Mm-hmm. Immediately tell your parents. So... one of the preschool teachers was helping the kids make like Shavuos cards. Don't tell mommy, it's a surprise, right? Yeah. So they all ran home.
They got the message.
Right. Because the teacher said the trigger word.
Right.
So, okay. All right, 225. Not to deny it when something of value that belongs to another is in our possession. So here, somebody didn't steal, but this is the edge of stealing. So somebody entrusts something into your value or lends you something, and then you say, I don't have it. Right, so you didn't. So the difference here is you didn't take it,
but you're denying that you own it.
But now you're denying that you have it. So that is in effect stealing, but it's a different action.
Right.
It's not a taking of it. So, and it's also connected into not swearing a false oath, which is a very long section, which I just re-looked up quickly. But it's pages and pages and pages. Actually, it's one of those long mitzvot. So mitzvah number 30, this is how long it is, right? It's like 10 pages. Just no, in the Sefer Chinuch. Just on mitzvah
35?
Number 30.
Number
30. Mitzvah 30. Not to swear in vain, right? So
we did that such a long time ago, we can't even remember.
Right, exactly. That's why I re-looked it up.
I wasn't talking about you.
Right. Right. Right, so you're not allowed to swear something in vain, and so that, he says there's lots of different ways to swear in vain. You're not allowed to swear that something is, something that obviously is that thing. So you can't say, somebody wouldn't be permitted to swear that this table is made out of wood. It's obviously made out of wood. So you're not allowed, that's in vain. You don't need to swear that it is.
Oh.
So obvious.
Well, that's interesting.
That you're not allowed to swear that.
You can't swear something that's obviously what it is.
Correct.
Hmm.
Right.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I'll just read this. So, four possible ways to swear in vain, which means purposeless swearing. One, somebody swears that something is known that is not so, saying this table is marble.
Okay.
So we all know it's wood, right? Not allowed to swear falsely like that, right? Or you're not allowed to swear that something is known is so. You can't swear that it's wood. The third thing, somebody can't swear to violate a mitzvah. That he's bound to observe.
Can't swear. What
can't
is that?
Swear.
That he's going to violate.
Can't swear that the person's going to break Shabbos. Can't swear that this coming Shabbos, you know.
I'm not going
to
do
it. I am not going to do it. You can't swear that because you're not permitted to swear. That's a vain thing. You're required to keep it. So you can't swear that you won't. Because swearing, remember, part of the function of swearing is that it creates something on you. So that you can't swear something that is against what you're permitted to do. And the fourth thing is to swear something that he doesn't have the power or strength to do. Like he can't swear that he won't sleep for 3 days in a row or not eat for 7 days in a row. You can't swear something that you can't do. That you, it's not
this
possible
is all, I mean, this
do.
Is all in the context that making oaths and swearing is like this super huge thing, as I remember.
Right, it is. So at the root of the precept lies the aim that human beings should know and affirm in their minds and strengthen the faith in their hearts that there is no existence like that of God. Blessed is he who is in heaven above, living and enduring forever. So it is fitting and required of us when we mention his great name. So swearing is about saying in God's name, right? When we mention his great name in connection with our actions and our words, that we should mention him in awe and fear, quivering and trembling, not like mockers who speak of light, trivial matters. That, for example, things which exist fleetingly and then are lost to oblivion, not enduring in their original state, such as us human beings and other entities in this lowly world. Therefore, it is fitting to set this matter firmly in our hearts and to have his awe before us that we may find life and merit. So it's interesting because this reminds me of, what mitzvah does it remind you of that we spent a long time on?
Swearing in vain reminds us of?
Not swearing in vain. The root reason for this should remind you of the Beit HaMikdash, right? We spent a long time discussing the Beit HaMikdash and all the
awe
and reverence.
And
there's a lot.
Right.
Right. So the Kohanim can't go in with torn clothes or a beard a certain length or whatever it is.
Right.
All kinds of things. You can't bring in tattered things into the Beit HaMikdash or
so
offer
can,
things with moves.
It's all about your...
It's about creating
yeah.
the internal reverence and awe. How do we do that?
Have.
Right. So the not swearing in vain, it doesn't hurt God to take his name in vain.
Right.
So really,
it hurts us, right?
Really,
so,
it's connected to stealing. Stealing doesn't hurt God.
Right.
It only hurts, I mean, clearly it hurts the person from whom it's
right.
stolen, but it
right.
also,
diminishes
perhaps
your...
more significantly...
Right, diminishes us. Mm-hmm. And then makes it possible for us to go in different places. Right, so once we can take God's name in vain, once we don't really have reverence or awe for certain things, once we've broken that down, it's very easy to go additional places, right? And, I mean, it's interesting to look at our society and see
like
how that happens.
Fence and being...
Right, and just see, like, you know, our lack of reverence for pretty much all authority figures.
I was going to say parents, teachers,
parents,
whatever.
Teachers, police officers, all of them. You know, I mean, today in the New York Times, and I just can't believe it. My husband was shocked by this. I don't know what the research actually was. But the headline was that by age 23, one-third of the United States population has been arrested for a crime, other than traffic.
One-third now.
One-third by age 23. So he said he doesn't believe it. Are they counting not multiple arrests?
And not convicted.
Doesn't matter, convicted. Arrested. Arrested for a crime other than traffic violations.
Well, I would have a question. What percentage of our population are minorities?
And this study didn't look at that.
And we know from other stuff that minorities
that it's a growing
subjected
number
to that at a much higher percentage.
Right.
So that's that.
Yeah.
Would be
so, right. So we're at 5%, and they're at 80%.
Is it 90% of minorities are arrested by age 23?
Which impacts that? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, to me, mm-hmm. I mean, I remember one time. Yeah.
Right. But, so
you know these three kids who were recently. Caught. They were, I don't know what exactly all that they had done, but there were three siblings.
They were doing the cross country thing.
I recently saw that one of them, I think he was 21 years old, and he already had like something like 8 or 10 arrests.
And the girl has.
I'm not so sure about that.
No, it's not just minorities only,
sure. But statistically, it is much higher.
Doesn't really matter. One third.
Right. So huge.
Right. So it does matter statistically. Are they counting number of arrests? So one 23-year-old who has 10 arrests.
Does that count
10 times across the population, or is that one person? So I don't know exactly. But anyway, it seems very high. So it's higher. It's actually in the 60s it was measured differently, though. But it was in the low 20s. This is in the low 30s.
People being arrested today for drugs.
Yes. So that's one thing it said. Maybe it's just higher drug arrests or higher or more vigilance and no. Right. Nonetheless, it does create a lack of respect for authority. And we see that certainly in the classroom. Right, less respect for authority, less respect probably of teachers to principals, less respect of students to teachers, less respect of children to parents, less respect of children to other authority figures,
and
other people's parents, and even to one another.
Right? The bullying thing we know is
it's like they don't respect.
Do you see that in Montessori too? Bullying?
Not the same kind of bullying.
Yeah.
You see lots of real bothering, but not so much bullying.
Yeah. Well, they have a whole Rose system, which is respect other self and environment, and so they work with that a lot.
They have a pretty peaceful school.
What do they do outside the school when they go off the school grounds? Are there kids that pick on other kids?
Well, they have it at Abigail School. Montessori.
Well, it's big in elementary schools and the secular.
Well, I mean, that's Montessori will teach values as opposed
to... It does.
They do teach values. But, Abigail and Ian go to that Montessori school and the kids still tease one another.
Teasing, for sure. So anyway, part of this not swearing is... to create an environment of respect, right? That we need to maintain a sense of awe and trepidation even, but a sense of awe and respect, and that has to be cultivated within us. And so not swearing falsely, which is mitzvah number 30, helps assist with that. And here, specifically in the list of stealing things, in this section that we're looking at here, not to swear a false denial about something of value is akin to stealing. So so here we have not swearing falsely, 227. So which is really two violations. So not swearing falsely would be 227. Clearly, that's l'nishba l'sheker. You're not allowed to swear falsely. And then it also violates number 30, to not take the Lord's name in vain, right? Which isn't actually how it goes, to not take the Lord's name in vain, but it's not swear in God's name. 227, you should not swear falsely. As it is stated, you shall not swear by my name falsely. And the sages of blessed memory explain that this verse enjoins us against an oath of expression. Now, an oath of expression is what we find in the Torah, or if anyone swears clearly with his lips to do harm or to do good, and it divides into four types, two in the past and two in the future. For instance, if one swears about something that is past, that it was done or that it was not done, or about something that is going to be, that he will do it or not do it, right? So that's the four types of swearing. So two in the past, two in the future. So in the past, right, I did pick up your clothes from the cleaners, right? I didn't, I didn't cut that thing. I didn't ruin that thing, right? So you're swearing in the past or in the future, I will do that thing or I won't do that thing. So that's swearing in the future. Those are the four types of swearing that it would be that you're not permitted to swear falsely. So that's using God's name in the swearing. An oath of expression is one that can apply only to things which a man is able to do, either in the past or in the future. How in the past? I ate or did not eat. So too, I threw or did not throw a stone into the sea. And how in the future? I will eat or I will not eat again, or I will throw or will not throw. However, no things on which there is a restriction of the Torah, no oath of expression,
two things.
And where there's on things, that's what it is, on things on which there's a restriction of the Torah, no oath of expression can apply. Because an oath can take effect on nothing but a voluntary matter. So you can't say, I promise I will or won't, or I will, let's see, you can't say, I promise I will violate Shabbat, or you can't say, I promise I won't light Shabbos candles, right? Because you are obligated to light them, and you're, right, obligated to keep it. So you can't promise to break something or to not do something that you're supposed to do. So that wouldn't count in this. However, you're still not supposed to say that kind of thing, but that wouldn't count in this. It wouldn't be technically a shavua. So the question is, what is a shavua, and what punishments, you know, legally? It's not. So again, when we look at halacha, so we are looking at the underlying reasons for things, but when you actually look at halacha, you have to define what the thing is so that you know exactly what it is, so that you know how to fix it and how to punish for it, right? So... So swearing about something that you can't swear about wouldn't count as a shavua. Let's see. And then there's just all, it's interesting all the things here about it, so we're not going to go through the whole thing, but just the concept of not, you're not permitted to swear falsely. 228, not to withhold another person's property wrongly. That we should not retain the property of another person that is in our possession, either through force or by procrastination and trickery. Like wrongdoers who put off people and say, go and come back, so as to arrange matters that the other's property which they hold should remain with them. You know, so if somebody lends you a rake and they want it back, but you didn't rake your yard yet, and you don't want to have to borrow it back, you could say, oh, my garage is a mess. I'm not sure where it is. Do you mind coming next week and I'll find it for you next week? You know, so you're not allowed to do that, just so that you could keep the rake for the week so that you can use it or whatever. You have to go find it, and you have to go give it back, and you have to borrow again. But you're not allowed to put somebody off. So again, you have the property fairly at some point, and now it's switching into unfairly, right? Because you're putting them off and not returning it. So you're not allowed to do that.
If you borrow something from someone, you should return it.
Yes, you should. Well, so it depends on the deal that you made with the person.
If you borrowed it, you're going to intending to use it, so you should use it.
But let's say for whatever reason, I don't know, you have two blenders, right? And somebody says, I need to borrow a blender. And you say, fine, take my second one, right? So once you say that, it's not, if the person says, I need a blender for a milkshake, so they should make the milkshake, wash it, and return it to you. But if they say, I need a blender, you say, borrow mine. So you didn't put an end to that.
You didn't say, I need it back.
They don't have to return it tomorrow or the next day. They might check in with you after a month or so or whatever, in a year. But as soon as, I'm saying, they're not obligated to return it right away if you didn't say, I need it back by whatever. So what I'm saying is this is not obligating the person to return it right away. That's not what this is doing. That would have to do with the terms of the loan, right? So because sometimes you loan things for a long time. You really don't mind. You have an extra blender. What do you care? Like, if you don't care. But sometimes you do care, right? But now you want it back because the shul is having smoothie night, right? And you need two blenders, right? So you need to get it back. So now the person has to get it back to you right away. Right, so now you have to ask them for it back, and I have to give it back to you right away. It's not okay for them to say, no, it's in the basement, I can't find it, it's on a shelf. Now they have to return it to you right away. That's what this is saying.
So my niece's pearls, when she wants them, I have to give them to her.
Correct, but you can borrow them until she asks, right? Right, so, and that kind of muttering somebody is called oshek, right? You're not allowed to just mutter somebody and bother them, come back, I'm not sure, I don't know, you're not allowed to do that.
Borrowing becomes thievery pretty quickly.
Right, so it can. It can cross that line. right, so that, again, this is the difference of that you got it fairly, but now you're crossing the line, you're retaining it unfairly. Mm-hmm. But not only are you retaining it unfairly, You're muttering the person about it. That's the oshek aspect. You're not allowed to do that. You're not allowed to cause them additional tsar. Not only don't they have their thing, but you're bugging them to come back every time, and they now have ajda over it. So you're not allowed to do that. It's a separate prohibition. And finally for today, before we get to a little bit of Hanukkah, the prohibition against committing robbery. So robbery is to steal, take something that we have no right to take by might and force openly. So to grab somebody's purse, to snatch something away, to push them down and take it out of their hand, whatever it is, you're not allowed to do that, obviously. But it's a separate aveira. Really, if you steal something, so you would be transgressing two different kinds of things here to take it, right? You're not allowed to steal anything of value, and you're not allowed to steal that value from force, right? So why give extra things? Let's see, is this where he says it? But I forgot which mitzvah he says it in. Anyway, so we just discussed that you're not allowed to. The reason why he says extra things is not because he wants to make Jews look, not that God wants to pile on halachas that we could transgress so that Jews will be look bad, but rather to give us many pathways that when we refrain from doing it, we actually protect our souls. So here, you can't steal anything by force, and not even from an idol worshiper. It's not good for us. Even somebody that could be killed legally, you're not allowed to do it. If you look on page 43 in the middle, it says, a man should not accustom his nature to this, for the spirit will acquire a defect by becoming accustomed to inferior and evil traits of character, and this becomes a strong rope to draw iniquity. So it is bad for a person to steal. And then there's all kinds of laws on how you return it and how you pay for it, and do you have to just return the thing, how you make restitution for it, and all that kind of stuff. Or if you denied that you owned it or stole it in different ways and didn't make restitution yourself, you had to be brought to court. You have to add a fifth, or you have to double the value. There's all kinds of different laws. But if you yourself just return it, you say, you know, you finally are doing tshuva, and the person didn't yet take you to court, you can just return it. You don't have to return it with extra. So anyway, all these laws are detailed. If you look up the places where they're detailed in Baba Kama. Okay, so I was trying to think, how does this relate to Hanukkah? Okay, so I think it relates to Hanukkah in the stealing, because that's what the Greeks tried to do to us. And it was both kinds of stealing. Right, there is the geneva and the gazela. So in this case, gazela would be the decrees that the Greeks made against the Jews. No Shabbos, no Rosh Chodesh, no Bris Milah, no learning Torah. Right, so those are the four key decrees that they made. And they were aimed, those decrees were made in concert with the Hellenists. So the Hellenists are the Jews that switched sides. However, those Jews who switched sides knew enough about Judaism to be able to advise the Greeks, what decrees should you make? So they made those four decrees specifically to strike at the root of Judaism. So no Shabbos, no standing back from the world, recognizing that God runs the whole thing, no recognition of God's sovereignty. There's Greek sovereignty. So no Shabbos is saying, I don't want you doing anything now that will recognize God's sovereignty. And no refraining from engagement. The whole Greek thing is about engaging in the world. Engage in it and make it yours. Engage in it in many different ways, but it's about engagement. So no refraining from engagement, the Jewish thing, once a week.
Or intermarriage.
That does not have to do with Shabbos.
No, not with Shabbos.
No, I'm saying the Greek. No. These four That's things, Shabbos. Right? No Shabbos, right? Now, no Rosh Chodesh. Right, Rosh Chodesh is about renewal, about knowing that you can constantly remake yourself, that you are not born as you are and you have to stay how you are. You're born one way and you are absolutely free to change yourself again and again and again. That is the concept of Rosh Chodesh, is constant renewal. We can constantly innovate, constantly make ourselves different. There is no such thing as being born a certain way, which was part of the Greek philosophy. That's how you're born. You're born into your station. You're born into your life trajectory, you're born into your capabilities, and that's what you have. And there isn't changing that, which is one reason why they opposed Bris Milah. So Bris Milah, so that was number three, no Bris Milah, so that was about no, first of all, no harming the physical body, right? The physical body was venerated. The Olympics were done naked. Everybody wanted to see the whole body in its perfection. And slicing away a part of it is causing a lack of perfection. So it's the opposite of how we see it.
Right.
And it's interesting that the Israeli army adopted the Greek position on this, because the Israeli army profiles, they give a profile, a number profile to every soldier on how healthy they are, right? The top that you, so 100 is the most healthy, right? The highest a soldier can get is 97.
Because they're already.
Because of Prismila. Because they have.
That's weird.
Yeah, there That's is really a defect. And so, and female That's soldiers really too. Weird. That's as high as you can get is 97. That's,
but why is it with women?
Just because that's as high as you can get.
I see. So there is no 100.
There is no 100. You can't get 100. Even somebody who's not circumcised wouldn't get 100. You just are assuming circumcision. Right. So, like, let's say some of the Russian soldiers that come in that wouldn't be circumcised, they don't get 100, I don't think. But it's interesting, the idea.
Weird.
It's a secular idea that's in the Israeli army that 100 is the highest, 97 is the highest you can get because of Prismila.
All that stuff, all those places like in San Francisco and stuff where they're trying
right.
to...
they are trying to reverse it. Right. Anyway, so there's that. But that's a Greek idea. The idea that, so the Jewish idea of circumcision is that it's perfecting.
Right.
Right? That we're born a blob, and it's our job to make ourselves into a mensch. So the Bris Mila is our first statement to the child. You don't have to stay how you're born. Change yourself. You're born to be changed. We're going to start the change right here with a concrete bris, but this bris is about binding you, a covenant of always changing, change to connect. But you don't stay how you're born. Change yourself and change yourself to connect. So that's Rismila. And then, of course, No Learning Torah is about connecting and renewal, and all of it is bound into learning Torah. The more you learn Torah, the more you step outside of Greek philosophy, really, the deeper the Torah you learn. So those four things were meant to get the Jews ready to be Hellenized, to become part of that. So this exile, which we've mentioned in the past, is unique. Let's see if you can remember. Why is this exile unique? If you put all the other exiles together, and let's just do the four main ones. So the main exile, the Avha, is Egypt. The Avha exiles, the father of all exiles, the source of all exiles is Egypt. But then there's four exiles that we talk about. So there's the
Babylonian,
Persian, Greek, and Roman. Those four exiles. Which of these things is not like the other?
Multiple choice test.
Uh-huh.
So
the Greeks didn't make us leave.
That's what I was
going
to say.
It was not an exile. That's correct. Right. This was the only exile where we remained in our land. But it is considered an exile. So what was exiled was our intellect. Our intellect is exiled, not our bodies. Right? So that is the Geneva. Well, that's the Gazela, first of all. So the Gazela was the decrees where they took by force. The Geneva was the beauty, the intellectual discourse, the philosophic conversations, the beautiful architecture, the lovely language. The Talmud says Greek is the most beautiful language. Right? So the beauty of, and it's not just the beauty of the physical beauty of Greek culture, but there's an intellectual beauty.
The logic and
the logic and the philosophy that Jews were so attracted to it. Because we love intellectual stuff. And so Greek culture was very attractive. It's interesting, as opposed to Persian culture, where the Gemara relates that the Persians were like hairy bears. They were boors. And so that's one reason why we did not assimilate into the Persian culture at all, into Babylonia. We did not take on their
Greeks.
Stuff. We were not attracted to it. We remained separate. We've always been kind of elitist and snobby about who we are and how we think. And we're not lowering ourselves to the level of those hairy bears, the Persians. That wasn't us. But we sure loved the Greeks. That was very, very attractive to us. So it was not, that's what I want to say, they were pretty, but it wasn't just about the pretty.
It was
the intellectual beauty, right? It was Jews love opera and theater and novels, good writing, and architecture, and mathematics, and philosophy. All that's like brain candy. And the Jews were very attracted. So that's, I would say, would be the gazela, the geneva, the stealth stealing.
Right? Steal the
so there was both stealing
steal
by force and stealing by stealth going on at the time to steal away the Jewish intellect. And that the story of Hanukkah is the story of our struggle against that. Right? How will we maintain that which is ours? And so at first, a lot of Jews were sliding into it. And finally, the point of the Maccabees was they stood up and said, no, we can't let this go anymore. We have to fight for what's ours. And so when they took the temple back over, which was taken by force, but we just have to remember that, you know, all the stories that we hear about how the temple was destroyed and they had to fix it up, clean it up, not at all. The Greeks were all into beauty and architecture, and the temple was stunning. They didn't destroy a thing except for the inner workings of it, the Kedusha. That's what they destroyed. It was the Kedusha. So the physical temple remained the same. It was the Kedusha that was broken, and that's what had to be cleaned up, right? So what had to, it was really an intellectual struggle. So, and that's why it's symbolized by the menorah. The menorah, which is lit by oil which symbolizes intellect. It's oil that's used to anoint a king. It's put on his head, so it runs down a little bit. That's how you anoint. That's what a Mashiach is, anointed. So the oil represents intellect, and then oil can burn and shed light, like intellect sheds light into the world. So oil represents intellect. So when the Jews got the temple back, what they wanted to do was relight the menorah, send the Jewish light out into the world. But they couldn't find the right oil for that, right? Now, halachically, after a war, they were all tamei mate. We learned about Tumah and Tahara. So you know it takes 7 days to get untamei mate, and then on the eighth day, they can make the oil, right? But they didn't have tahor oil to put in the menorah. Under those circumstances, with everybody tummy mate, halachically, it would have been just fine to use whatever oil they had. But they didn't want to. Not because they just wanted the best, because the whole essence of the fight was about Kedusha and Tahara. That was the whole thing. So if they're going to relight the menorah, it has to be with what's tahor. Right? Tahor intellect. So that's what they searched for, was that one vial that was left that still had the Kohen Gadol's seal on it, right, that said, this is untainted Jewish wisdom. That's what you're going to pour into the menorah, is untainted Jewish wisdom. And that's what we're shining into the world, is that core of untainted Jewish wisdom. And that's what's so amazing about the whole Hanukkah story, is not only did we find it, and that's usually what we talk about, is the miracle and that it lasted for so long, but that we looked for it, that we knew there was such a thing, that we have a core of untainted Jewish wisdom, that's something that we can count on and look for. It's there. Even with all kinds of pollution surrounding us, there is a core of untainted Jewish wisdom that we need to access, and that's what can be used to light up the world. And that's the message of Hanukkah, right? Is looking for that. So may we all access our core of untainted Jewish wisdom and use it to shine into the world.